the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Welcome to this session of the Supreme Court. We welcome the lawyers, and we also welcome the public at large who may be listening on an audio cue that is set aside just for that purpose. All right, Ms. Quinn, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Lemons and fellow justices. May it please the court. My name is Colleen Quinn of Locke and Quinn, and I represent the appellant, Dr. Michelina Bonanno. Your Honors, I would like to reserve, Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal, please.
All right.
Your Honors, the Court of Appeals erred because standing was not necessary in this case in order for Dr. Bonanno to make her appeal. Under the clear law of Virginia Pilot Media Companies, it was unnecessary to discuss the question of standing by the Court of Appeals. In Virginia Pilot, the majority clearly says, quote, is unnecessary to discuss the question of standing in the present case because the court's orders entered in a case over which it has no subject matter jurisdiction, quote, are absolute nullities and may be impeached directly or collaterally by all persons anywhere, at any time, or in any manner, and may be declared void by every court in which they are called into question. And not only is the majority opinion instructive, but as is the concurring opinion by late Chief Justice Carrico and Justice Mims, those justices noted that the case presented in Virginia Pilot, a procedural Gordian knot, I had to look up the Gordian knot, as an intractable problem. And in the Virginia Pilot, the consenting decision said, we did not go out and pluck this case from thin air. The error was made known to us through a petition for appeal. Likewise, this court would not be made aware of a step-parent adoption that was secretly done and procedurally defective had not Dr. Bonanno acted quickly in the limited time frame that she had. She literally got a copy of the final order of adoption on the 22nd day. This was a sealed proceeding of which she could not find any record of in the courthouse because it was sealed. And in a moment of trickery, Mr. Quinn, knowing from his counsel that the trial court would lose jurisdiction over its final order on the 21st day, emails her on the 22nd day a copy of the final order, telling her that she's no longer now allowed to have any contact with her granddaughter, for whom she is the only legal custodian, her daughter having passed away and having committed suicide. Dr. Bonanno literally was sleeping on the couch in Mr. Quinn's house, caring for her granddaughter, given the death of the mother, and was comforting her while Mr. Quinn secretly goes and files an adoption unbeknownst to Dr. Bonanno. When Dr. Bonanno—
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this? Couldn't she file an action? Could she actually make a general appearance when she has standing in an action to collaterally attack the order or within 6 months of the final order in this case? Why is it necessary to jump into an appeal that she has no standing in, based on what is essentially a judicial hyperbole, the anytime, any place, anywhere? It can't possibly mean that. That's nonsensical, no matter what a splintered opinion might say.
Justice Kelsey, this case involves a case where she needed to move quickly, and to simply try to attack the order without filing an appeal would have risked going before the same trial court who already had mishandled a step-parent adoption, which was not effectively a step-parent adoption.
So she purposely doesn't file an action in circuit court that she theoretically would have standing as an interested party. She jumps into an appeal in a case that she has no standing, and we're supposed to say anytime, anywhere, we can just randomly go after pretty much any lower court opinion we think or order we think is void.
Yes, sir. I believe under the law of Virginia Pilot, yes, you can. And in Virginia Pilot, Justice Mims noted, we did not reach out and pluck this case from thin air. The error was made known to us through a petition for appeal. Now, Justice Kelsey, she did both. She actually filed the petition for appeal, and she also filed several different motions to vacate or make void the judgment. At that point, the trial court could have recognized that its final order of adoption was void, and therefore there could not be an appeal from an order that was void ab initio, and the trial court could have corrected its opinion at that point. But at that point, the trial court instead decided that because the case was up on appeal, that the court would not do anything. And we consider that court's ruling that it lacked jurisdiction to be a final order that also was appealable. At that point, my client had made an appearance before the trial court. So either way the court looks at it, whether you look directly at her first appeal or whether
let me ask you this question, see if this logically makes sense. Couldn't there be a whole battery of interest groups that just lay in wait, watch litigation go forward, and when they find a case that they think there's a void order in, and it could be for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, could be fraud in the inducement, could be extrinsic fraud, could be a lot of reasons that an order is technically void, and they can jump into a case in which they have zero standing, appeal it with zero standing, and we're just going to write an advisory opinion on the subject to benefit whatever interest group wants to jump into the case? Now,
Justice
I know your
Kelsey,
client's not an interest group, but the logic would suggest that. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Justice Kelsey, I hear your concern, but in this case, we had a person that was asserted a right in the suit, which was Justice Lemon's concern in Virginia Pilot. In this case, Dr. Bonanno did suffer a cognizable legal injury arising out of the order, and I don't think that the court ruling for Dr. Bonanno in this case will open the floodgates. That was something that the concurrence mentioned in Virginia Pilot when it said, quote, I do not believe the result in this case will invite outside parties to challenge orders in subsequent cases unadvisedly. As stated,
I realize
our action today arises.
Said, but you understand that the logic of it doesn't make sense. The logic is, no, that's exactly what could happen. We can deny it, but that's exactly the consequence of that logic.
Your Honor, Dr. Bonanno was the most aggrieved party who was left out of the proceedings, who did not have knowledge of the proceedings. Her counsel needed to act quickly in the time frame between the 22nd day and the 30th day to appeal. There is no guidance out there for lawyers, such as the lawyer in Dr. Bonanno's case, as to whether she should file the appeal, not file the appeal, file a motion to vacate. There's no guidance. So the lawyer did what she needed to do, which was to file an appeal immediately so that this court could rectify an error as it did in Virginia Pilot. If we look at the very clear language of Virginia Pilot, it does say that orders can be challenged. And in that case, where the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction, this court said that it was unnecessary to discuss the question of standing. So I don't know why we keep coming back to standing when in Virginia Pilot said that was not necessary, because that orders can be attacked by all persons anywhere at any time or any manner and may be declared void by every court in which they are called into question. And just like Virginia Pilot, were it not for Dr. Bonanno, this court would not be made aware of the error of the trial court. So just like the concurrence in Virginia Pilot, Dr. Bonanno brought this to this court's attention that this court lacked subject matter in the very beginning. In the case of Virginia Pilot, the courts also indicated that Justice Lemons was concerned that in Virginia Pilot that the party was not an aggrieved party. But in this case, we do have an aggrieved party. We have the most aggrieved party. We have the only person that had any legal standing to be a custodian over this child, who was secretly just had her rights cut out from under her without even knowing that this secret adoption proceeding was going on, and not knowing about it until suddenly she's presented with this final order. Because also of the statute of repose.
Excuse me, counsel. Excuse me for interrupting you, but this is Justice Chaffin. Perhaps I misread the facts in this case, and I realize it's really a standing issue case, but you say she had no, that Dr. Bonanno had no knowledge of this until she got the final order of adoption. Well, didn't the Department of Human Services contact her? They tried to contact her on several occasions and then ultimately spoke. They sent her a certified letter, according to our court records. And they also talked with her over the phone before the adoption was entered. Is that not correct?
Justice Chafin, yes, the record does reflect that Department of Social Services contacted Dr. Bonanno to ask her about her position on an adoption. However, it was never presented to her that there was an actual adoption case that was pending. She was never provided with a case number, with a courthouse. That was never provided to her. Instead, this is a young social worker that is simply asking her about the situation, and she indicates that she would never agree to an adoption. She's not told that this case is in the process of proceeding. She's not told that she needs to make an appearance in the case. And so she was not made a party. She was not given actual notice of actual proceedings that were taking place. She was left in the dark about that.
Counsel, I understand she didn't have what we term legal notice, but she certainly had some notice that there was something going on in the court systems in reference to an adoption, because she said basically that she objected and
yes,
had
ma'am.
Concerns about the now parent. I realize that that's just an aside, but you state she had no notice. If she had acted at that time, as she has now, if she had acted, then the order of adoption had not been entered.
Justice Chafin, I understand your concern, but she went from courthouse to courthouse searching for an adoption file and could not find one. She did not know that it was not findable because it was under seal, which is the nature of adoption proceedings, which Mr. Quinn knew. I would like to please reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
I have a question before. Based on the procedural posture of this case, with post-trial motions being brought up on appeal, and a motion to vacate being joined with the original appeal, what is your understanding of the status of those post-trial motions, the motion and the motion to vacate?
As made clear, Justice Powell, by the trial court's order, the trial court put in its order that the court lacked jurisdiction to hear those motions and refused to hear anything further, and just leaving Dr. Bonanno again with no remedy. I believe that if this court feels like that the first appeal, that just Dr. Bonanno needed standing for the first appeal, she got the standing by getting in front of the trial court, by arguing that the trial court's order was void ab initio. The trial court at that point could have found that its order was void ab initio. It had all the briefing in front of it. It could have seen that it made a mistake, and at that point realized that if the order was void ab initio, then the appeal was no effect either. So either way, whether the court looks at the first appeal or the second appeal, I believe that Dr. Bonanno has standing. And I would like to please reserve my remaining 2 minutes. Thank you.
You have 1 minute, 57 seconds left. All right, for the appellees, you're representing the same parties, but there are two lawyers arguing. The first is Mr. Phillips. Is that correct?
Actually, Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is Laura Dove with the law firm of Mullett, Dove, Meacham & Bradley. I'm here with my co-counsel, Mr. Phillips.
All right, we haven't started the clock yet.
Okay.
You have the first 10 minutes, and Mr. Phillips has the remaining five. Because
yes,
you
sir.
Because you represent the same party, you're going to have to manage your time as you would like. There's 15 minutes going on the clock, and Ms. Dove, you want the first 10 minutes, you'll have to manage your time accordingly. All right, Ms. Dove, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Laura Dove. I'm with the law firm of Mullett, Dove, Meacham & Bradley in Arlington, Virginia. I'm joined today by my co-counsel, Stan Phillips. We're dividing the time such that I'll be addressing the jurisdictional and standing arguments, and Mr. Phillip will answer any questions regarding the procedures involved with the adoption itself. I think that the court has identified some of the very significant concerns, which is what brings us before the court and why the Court of Appeals granted our motion to dismiss for lack of standing. I think it's noteworthy, and I think that the court has picked up on this. Dr. Bonanno never filed a motion to adopt this child or attempted to intervene in any way in this adoption proceeding. And when the Court of Appeals granted the motion to dismiss, it is because she was not an aggrieved party to this litigation. Dr. Bonanno was informed of the fact that the adoption was proceeding. One of the challenges of handling an appeal with an individual who was not a party to the litigation is that Dr. Bonanno is introducing facts and evidence which are not part of the record. I too could offer facts that are related to efforts to resolve these issues before an adoption was filed. I could introduce evidence of other things that have occurred, but that's not evidence that's in the record, and it's not appropriate and it's not proper. So our focus is on who were the parties to this litigation. The parties to this adoption were my client, Mr. Quinn, and the birth father, who was noticed and properly included in this adoption proceeding. Unfortunately, the birth father had been absent from the child's life for a number of years and did not participate or elect to participate in this proceeding. The father has never filed a motion to intervene or to come back or somehow interject himself into the adoption proceedings. There has never been a challenge in that regard. So there are two issues or two theories upon which Dr. Bonanno contends that she managed to obtain standing. One is that she was an aggrieved party just because she wasn't included in the litigation. The second is that she was an aggrieved party because of the second appeal that she filed. I think there are two very distinct issues here. In the first one, if you look at Tidewater Psychiatric, an aggrieved party has significance, and that is emphasized in the Court of Appeals ruling, because in that ruling and in the way that our jurisprudence has developed, an aggrieved party is a party who actually participates in the litigation itself. So that is how that person helps to develop a record and arguments for the court to consider as to whether or not the court properly applied the law of Virginia. In this case, Dr. Bonanno was not a member of this litigation. So the only two parties that had standing to appeal this adoption were my client, Mr. Quinn, or the child's birth father, Mr. Graham. Dr. Bonanno then opines that she had achieved standing by her second appeal, which was essentially the appeal of a scheduling order. I take issue with the way that the trial court is being characterized in these proceedings. Judge DiMatteo carefully reviewed the status of this case. When Dr. Bonanno attempted to proceed in the trial court while this matter was on appeal to the Court of Appeals, if you look at the ruling of Judge DiMatteo, she was very careful and specific in her determination that she did not have subject matter jurisdiction over this issue at the time that Dr. Bonanno proceeded in the trial court after the final order of adoption. She specifically denied scheduling a hearing on the motions that were filed by Dr. Bonanno.
Counsel, Your Honor. Did the trial court judge ever rule or take any position on the motion to find the final order of adoption void ab initio?
She did not, Your Honor, because when Dr. Bonanno filed the motion to find the order void ab initio, she simultaneously filed notice of appeal and thereby divested jurisdiction from the trial court and transferred jurisdiction over this matter to the Court of Appeals. So the trial court never had the opportunity to consider or rule upon her motion or hear it because she simultaneously divested jurisdiction.
Did the Court of Appeals rule on the motion to find the order void ab initio?
No, Your Honor, because that motion was never ruled on and there was no final order entered by the trial court with regard to those motions because the trial court found.
So what is the status of that motion? What is your understanding of the status of that motion currently?
So Dr. Bonanno currently has multiple motions that she has filed in the trial court. The trial court has stayed all proceedings and has declined to schedule substantive hearings on the motions filed by Dr. Bonanno because the trial court did not have jurisdiction over the matter at this time.
So no court has ruled on that motion. Is that correct?
Correct.
And it's currently in the trial court being stayed. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it's significant to note that because it was denial of a scheduling order and was not a final order that had been adjudicated and was not an interlocutory order, the Court of Appeals never technically acquired subject matter jurisdiction over those motions that had been filed by Dr. Bonanno because they were not substantively ruled on and there was no final order that the Court of Appeals had the ability to review or opine as to the order itself. I also think it's important to note that there are questions as to whether or not the court made this adoption order under the general provisions of adoption law or whether or not it was under a step-parent adoption simply because the word step-parent was in the title of the final order, even though that code section was not referenced in the final order of adoption itself. Mr. Phillips is going to speak to that directly, and I think that will help to clarify for the court why this order was not void ab initio, why the trial court had subject matter jurisdiction, and why, as Justice Kelsey has identified, we must be careful not to open up litigation for any person to file appeals of orders and rulings of the court if they have not been a participant in the litigation and are thereby not an aggrieved party with standing to appeal.
This is Justice Kelsey. One of the concerns I have about this whole subject matter is that under the U.S. Constitution, Article 3, Case and Controversy, has a standing component, and it makes it unconstitutional under case and controversy boundaries for a federal court to hear certain cases without constitutional standing. And yet, the arguments that are usually bantered about in this everywhere, anytime, any place, any manner, hyperbole, seems to not recognize that a similar concept may or may not apply under the Virginia Constitution. We don't use the term case or controversy, but we use the term judicial power, which is a loaded term to incorporate the common law understanding of jurisdiction. That's not something briefed in this case, but is that any concern of yours?
I would say that's not a concern, and I would note that I think that there is a subtle distinction that should be identified here. In the cases that were identified in appellant's brief, in each of those cases, the party seeking standing on appeal, whether it was in a motion to intervene or a motion to challenge a judgment, first brought that challenge and was heard in the trial court. They were not raising issues for the very first time on appeal that had not also been submitted to and ruled upon by the trial court, whether that was a denial of a right to intervene or a denial of the right of the party to participate. So I think that's a distinction. I'm not sure if that's directly on point, Your Honor, but I think that goes to why we don't say any court at any time and that hyperbole. There is a procedure that we still follow. If you're denied the right to participate in the trial court proceedings, you appeal it to the Court of Appeals. And in that circumstance, you are appealing the fact that you were denied the right to participate. You're not attempting to introduce evidence for the first time on appeal. Your Honor, I see that my time is almost ended, and I don't want to deny Mr. Phillips the opportunity to address the adoption-specific concerns or questions that the court may have. So I would yield my time to Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Stanton Phillips. I'm co-counsel for Mr. Quinn. I'm here before the court to address any questions the court may have on the technical issues. There's four points I'd like to address. First, the code provides alternate routes that somebody can take to reach the same result. Here, Mr. Quinn followed the general statutory route under Article 1, and there he had a clear path to be able to accomplish an adoption. Second, Mr. Quinn uses the term step-parent to describe how the placement occurred. This is a requirement under 63.2.1201 where you have to describe how the child came into the household. The term step-parent appears only one time in the final order of adoption, and it appears in parentheses under as a subheading. My third point is the trial court speaks through its orders and is presumed to correctly apply the facts and the law. Here, the trial court followed the statutory scheme under the general provisions of Article 1 of the Adoption Code and did not use any of the procedures under Article 4, which is the step-parent. Article 1 is where the basic adoption code. Article 4 is a minute provision, specialty provision, that only deals with, you know, it's a permissible procedure allowed in step parents, but doesn't require all step parent adoptions to follow that procedure. If you look at the wording of the orders that were in this case, the order of reference does not cite the step parent statutes, does not cite 63.2.1241, but it only cites 63.2.1208, which is a code section under Article 1. The order granting the adoption itself makes no reference to any code sections under Article 4. It makes two cites of code sections, both under Article 1. The fourth point I'd like to bring before the court is the appellant was not on the statutory list of persons entitled to receive notice or consent. Currently, the law has been amended in 2019 as a result of this case to include notice to a custodian. But you know, why does a custodian receive notice now or even back, you know, involved back then? Is to give counsel, their input.
Counsel.
Yes.
This is Justice Mims. Do I properly interpret your argument to be that you're saying that Ms. Bonanno, Dr. Bonanno, is not a necessary party?
At the time this case was filed and heard, she was not. As a result of this case, the legislature amended the statute in 2019 to include a notice requirement, not a consent requirement, but a notice requirement.
Prior to that statutory amendment, though, is she not a necessary party under our CISCA line of cases?
Correct. And
why?
It is not in the statutes. Even a guardian's consent is not required. There's an alternative provision for that.
Is your argument that the necessary party doctrine is purely statutory?
Correct. Adoption is statutory.
I understand that adoption is statutory, but is it your argument is that you cannot be a necessary party in an adoption case unless the statute specifically says that you have that you must receive notice of the proceeding? Is that correct?
That is what the statutes state.
Is that your argument? Is that your argument prior to the 2019 amendment?
Correct. What the purpose of the notice now is to be able to get her input. We did give her input in this case through the court's statutory investigator, designated investigator. And her input is to determine what is in the child's best interest. And that the court determined in this case. It through its investigator, got her input and made its determination. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
This is Justice Kelsey. Under common law preceding the statute or equitable principles, was there any such thing as adoption?
No, adoption did not exist under common law.
So necessary and proper party status, which supposes substantive law, would track the statute because the statute is exclusive of all matters involving the underlying adoption. Is that your position?
Correct, Your Honor.
Which provision of the code are you proceeding under with regard to consent? Is it 1202, or you're saying it's not 1241? Is it 1202?
Correct. 1202.
Well, under 1202, doesn't that require consent of both parents for step-parent adoption?
No, it does not. The wording under 1201 is different than under 1241. Under 1201, it says that if a parent is married, both spouses must join in the petition.
So you're under 1201 and not 1202?
1202 is the consent provision, 1201 is the court's jurisdiction provision.
Right. So 1202, consent shall be executed by the birth mother and any man who. So it seems to envision both the birth mother and the birth father.
Correct.
The birth mother and any man who. So clearly I would agree with you that the birth father had not had any contact with the child, so that's covered. But if it requires the birth mother and the birth mother is deceased, how can you proceed under 1202?
Under 1203, there are provisions to get around a birth parent consenting.
Which is the, tell me what, which specific one under 1203, please? The get around, the work around.
And there is under 12, also under 1202, I apologize, I don't have the statute in front of me, but there's a provision that says with respect to a deceased birth parent in one of the later sections of 1202. But 1203 gives the court general jurisdiction to waive a birth parent consent.
All right, Justice Powell, has he answered your question?
Yes, thank you, Chief.
All right, your time has expired. Ms. Quinn, you have a relatively small amount of time, 1 minute and 57 seconds. Ms. Quinn, I hate to ask a question to you right out of the box with 1 minute and 57 seconds left, but this is, I think, a very important issue, and I don't want you to be blindsided by it. In Title 17, there is a reference to who may appeal to the Court of Appeals. It's 17.1405, and it makes specific reference to adoption. And it says, any final decision, and any aggrieved party may appeal to the Court of Appeals from, and the list of things that follows thereafter, and it refers to adoption. How do you deal with the appellate statute that says any aggrieved party may appeal to the Court of Appeals? I understand what it would say, who it would include if it said any aggrieved person, but it says any aggrieved party may appeal to the Court of Appeals from, and the adoption statutes are listed therein. So how do you deal with the standing to appeal if you're not a party under the statutes of Virginia?
Your Honor, first of all, Virginia Pilot does not say party, it says all persons. But second of all, Ms. Quinn,
statutes override court decisions. So what I'm telling you is that 17.1405 is a statute, and it says any aggrieved party may appeal to the Court of Appeals from, and then the number of things that are listed there include adoption. All right, so go ahead. How do you deal with that statute?
I don't think the statute says that a non-party can't appeal. And moreover, my client should have been made a party. I never would have done this adoption without giving notice to the legal guardian or custodian. Otherwise, Justice Kelsey's concern about opening the floodgates applies the other way. Any person can file any adoption that's procedurally defective, which Mr. Quinn was not a party. He was not an appropriate party to a step-parent adoption. He wasn't an appropriate party to any adoption because under 63.212.02, no consent was ever included with the petition. And that statute says no petition for adoption shall be granted unless written consent to the proposed adoption is filed with the petition. So it's a conundrum, Your Honor, because my client should have been made a party. And had she been made a party, we wouldn't be in this whole mess to begin with. She, under the constitutional provisions for a legal custodian, she should have been made a party. Her consent should have been required, and that was not done. Your Honor, I see my. I'm not sure if my time is up.
No, go ahead.
Or if I've been given time back.
Ms. Quinn, hold on just a second. Go ahead and finish answering the question I've posed, and after that, Justice Mims has a question.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, it is my position that she was an aggrieved party, or she should have been made a party. The moment she was given notice that the final order had been entered, at that point she became a party when she made her appeal. And that would be our position in the case. I think under Virginia Pilot, it's pretty clear that any person can raise the issue before the court, before the appellate court. And it was important to appeal because of the statute of repose. And in the court's ruling, at a minimum, we would ask that this court find that the appeals in these cases told the 6 months. So if this court decides that this has to go back down to the trial court, which we don't believe to be necessary, I don't think the trial court is going to reverse its ruling. And we need this court to correct this error in this case. I'm sorry, Justice Mims, yes, your question, please.
Yes, counsel. And the tolling issue is indeed an interesting one in terms of how that statute would be interpreted. I'm not sure that the tolling question is before us, but I want to go back to Virginian Pilot, which, as Justice Kelsey mentioned, was an unusually fractured court, a three-judge plurality, a two-judge dissent, and a two-judge concurrence that did not join the plurality on many of the questions. This court, the seven members of the current court, attempted to untie the Gordian knot in Watson versus Commonwealth in 2019. And in that one, we pointed out that perhaps the case itself was not properly before us in some instance, but certainly the Virginian Pilot was a party because it had filed a motion to intervene, and it was the motion to intervene that brought the Virginian Pilot in front of us. Now, this is a different situation because in that case, the issue was whether the court even had, the trial court even had jurisdiction to hear anything. And in this one, the trial court clearly had jurisdiction to hear adoption cases generally. But that the factor of the motion to intervene certainly was important to this court in the Watson case. So I want to give you the opportunity to draw a distinction or to indicate why the failure of there to be a motion to intervene in this particular case is or is not significant.
Justice Mims, I hear your concern. And in Virginia Pilot, they had notice of the actual court proceedings. In this case, my client was not given notice of the actual court proceedings. We are asking the court to make an unusual exception in this case, just as they did in Virginia Pilot. And as you and Chief Justice Carrico noted in that decision, Justice Mims, you noted that I do not believe the result in this case will invite outside parties to challenge orders in subsequent cases unadvisedly. And you also noted that in that case that the appellant had no standing, the appellee had no standing, the circuit court had no authority, and its order was void. It was an unusual case. This, too, is a very unusual case. And had it not been for Dr. Bonanno filing her appeal, the error would not be brought to this court's attention. She did not have the opportunity to intervene. It's our position that she should have had the opportunity to intervene. She should have had higher constitutional rights as the only existing legal custodian for this child, she should have been made a party. If the petitioner did not make her a party, the court should have made her a party, just out of constitutional principles. But to cut her legs out from under her with a secret adoption proceeding, we are asking this court to correct that error. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your argument. The clerk will call the next case.